So we're going to continue to follow the As Sensei format from the new book, Three Principles of Oneness. Tonight's question is, what does it mean to be enlightened? And here is our reading. The one in whom no longer they believe, in other words, the one in whom no longer believes that doing and having define them, and they no longer perpetuate delusion, how could Mara attract them? How can Mara attract the awakened, which is trackless and boundless? The Buddha Shakyamuni. Now, I paraphrase that a little bit because the language is a little arcane. But it's a good reading. Good reading. So, what does it mean to be enlightened? What's interesting today is, even though for Buddhism, enlightenment is the core concept or idea, you find that people shy away from it. They shy away from it a bit in terms of trying to define it. And I think in some ways they do that because they're being humble. And in other ways, I think it's because they think it's something so transcendent, so grand, that, you know, it's kind of beyond us. And I always remind people, if that's the case, then, you know, we're wasting our time. Enlightenment is not something that is unattainable, and nor is it something that we have to wait until we ascend to some higher sort of realm of being. Enlightenment is something that we can all experience. And in the Buddhist tradition, enlightenment and what it does it mean to be enlightened is clearly laid out. One of the things you can always rest assured when it comes to this tradition, this faith tradition, things are spelled out. And there's usually a step-by-step process to get where you want to go. And that was really one of the things that attracted it to me. Now, the context for the story of enlightenment, there are usually two versions. One is sort of the mythic version. And by myth, I don't mean necessarily something that is, I certainly don't mean something that's not true. In our, you know, pedestrian parlance, when something is a myth, people say it's false. So I certainly don't use it in that way. I use it in the old way, the old Socratic sense. That a myth was a way to convey something large, some great truth that could not be contained in some smaller vessel. And so myth is a way for us to open up to these truths and to do so in a way that is timeless. So the context for the idea of enlightenment, which I think you have to talk about at least for a moment before you say, what does it mean to be enlightened? And the context is essentially that the human being finds himself, herself, in a world of delusion. In other words, a world that has been created by the ego self. And this ego self, the creation of this ego self, is the accumulation of, at least for us as humans, billions of years of conditioning. Now, in the mythic language, the idea was that, you know, that has created a state where our consciousness, in a sense, is trapped in a material world. And that what we see and perceive is not the real world, but it is a world of illusion that has been created by the ego self. And that when we awaken, we see through this illusion. And the great sages and teachers are those who help us to wake up. When we're in that place where we are contained within this illusion, we are trapped in a sense. And we are the walking dead. We are asleep. And the role of the Buddhas, the teachers, is to awaken us from that slumber of separation, and awaken us to the wonder of the true nature of reality, of the oneness of all. And so Buddha represents the liberator who brings that light within that darkness. And Mara represents the ego self, writ mythically large. Now, you can also talk about this in another fashion. You can leave the language of old myth behind, and you can use our modern myth of science. There's a book, a very good book, called Why Buddhism is True by Robert Wright. And in there, he takes this context, this mythic context, as we have done, and he places it in a different sort of narrative, where basically the conditioning of our ego selves, this conditioning that we talk about, that has accumulated after all these years, and that it is driven for one thing. It's driven to promote the gene. Richard Dawkins talks about this as the selfish gene. And that's all the organism is sort of created to do, if you think of evolution as creating it, in a sense. And so we have to wake up. We have to wake up and realize what's happening, and then our consciousness, the same one that brings all this existential angst, is the same consciousness by which we can be liberated, and we can see through that conditioning and no longer be defined by it. So it's kind of cool, because you can use both languages to sort of tell the same context and story. So that's the context in which it comes out. And, you know, people have different emphasis and different things that speak to them. I like both versions. So being enlightened ultimately means to see through the illusion, to have a great shift in consciousness. And of course, during the season of Satori, we celebrate the awakening of Shakyamuni as a model, an archetype for our own awakening. And honestly, in every liturgy, we replicate that as a reenactment, right? So that's the context. But let's talk about the things you look for to know if you're enlightened. And again, people say that sounds kind of arrogant, you know? But it's not. It's meant to be very practical. You should be able to look at yourself and others looking at you. They should be able to see these factors. Now, I want to be very clear about something from the get-go. This is not another quest for perfection. The spiritual path is not a quest for perfection. Why? Well, from our point of view, perfection does not exist. It is a delusion, an offspring of the deluded mind, which is largely used like a carrot or a stick to manipulate us. So let's be very clear that being enlightened or being awakened, Bodhi, does not mean some quest to be perfect. It's not possible. So I just want to start with that clarity. So in the classic presentation, there are seven factors that one can explore or one can reflect on to see if one is enlightened or awakened. Now the first one, and probably the one that's the most important, is to maintain the awareness of reality. Now the practice of this is mindfulness. Mindfulness is the practice of maintaining our perspective as much as we possibly can from reality. And what I mean by reality, not necessarily how things appear, but as they are. Because we project onto things. And so we don't see the thing itself. We project our own inner stuff onto it. So part of practice is waking up to the projections. And the most significant way that we offer to do this is the Four Directions system of mindfulness. This is a complete system and modern presentation of the Buddha's teachings in a way that is, I believe, easily communicated to people living in the 21st century. It's not the only version. There's always been multiple presentations throughout the 3,000-year history of Buddhism, but this is our contribution. And it has served us well. So that's the first thing. Am I practicing mindfulness? Am I practicing a mindful way of living? The second factor is, am I investigating the nature of reality? Am I studying it? Am I really investigating it? Am I taking the time to do that? The three principles of oneness is the primary way by which our Sangha does this. We investigate the nature of reality, and we discover that the universe yields three powerful metaphors that become principles and also practices. Third, one of the factors is energy. Now, this concept is also taught sometimes as one of the paramitas or paramitas, the vehicles to help us to be awakened. And in the word in Sanskrit is virya, and it means, it's the root of our word to have vigor or vitality. And how do you develop this energy within this approach? The number one way to do this is by caring for others. In other words, if we want to find energy at any given time, no matter how we're feeling, no matter what's going on in our life, if we turn our attention to the care of others, this will energize us. And I'm sure all of you have experienced this. You've been in sort of your own sort of, you know, ennui, and you know, you're kind of caught up in your own stuff, and there's some kind of crisis, right? A friend is in danger. And you suddenly find you rise to that occasion. You go to help that friend. And you have all the energy in the world. and you sort of shuffle off that bondage, even if it's just for that moment. And so that's how we cultivate energy. I know in my own life that the best way for me to be enlivened is to turn my focus over to the caring of others. And I'm lucky because that's what I've devoted my life to. So I get to do that every day. I remember my one spiritual mentor, Bernie Glassman, the great Zen teacher. I remember one time I was with him back in 95 or 96 at the Buddhism of America conference in Boston. And I remember he'd been traveling a lot. He was very, very tired. And I also had hosted him at Harvard Divinity School to give a talk. And I remember seeing him, and I even said to him, I said, you sure you want to, you know, you're up to this? I said, I can figure out a way around this. I can work this out. And he said, no, I'll be okay. And he was very tired. And we got in there, and it was packed to the gills in the Brown Room at Harvard Divinity School. And he got up, and he still looked kind of tired. But then he started to slowly teach the Dharma. And as he began to teach the Dharma, you could see his entire appearance change. And he radiated that wisdom, that compassion. And after it was over, you could see he had been energized. That's what they mean by that sense. Another factor, the fourth factor, joy. Now, when we think of joy, especially this time of the year, right? Joy to the world. We think of it as an emotional thing that's about us. You know, am I joyful? But what's interesting about our tradition is that they have a very specific understanding of the word joy. And it means joy in the joy of others. So just like energy is created by turning ourselves and our perspective over to the care of others, likewise, joy is in the joy of others. So that as I see them enjoying their life, as I see them experiencing good things and liberation, I experience joy, true joy, which always comes through my relationship with others. When a good friend does something for someone they care about, and they see the joy that that brings. There's nothing like that. There's nothing that quite brings that same spaciousness to us. Do you ever notice that? How like when we do things for ourselves and we just feel happy, it seems to be fleeting, but if we do something for someone else, it seems to have a bigger resonance. The fifth is relaxation or tranquility. And this means that if we're what it's like to be enlightened, besides practicing these things, we're practicing some practice of tranquility. And that can be many things. The primary version for us is to learn to abide, the form of meditation where we just abide, where we just bask in the oneness of things. No goal, just abiding. That's what we do here at the climax of each liturgy. And then there's another form of meditation, if you're enlightened, that you practice. And this form of meditation is where we watch and we observe what's going on in our mind and our bodies. It's the Japanese called moksu. It means to watch. And it's like having a vision of our mind as a big blue sky. And then there are clouds drifting through that sky. Some are dark, some are white and puffy, some are thin. That's how we view our thoughts. That's how we view our sensations and feelings. Transitory experiences, but not our true identity. The next practice, upekkha, is something that is a little more difficult for people to sometimes get, but I'm going to try here, see if I can offer you something that might be useful. The term is usually defined as equanimity or equipoise. So equanimity is a word that, you know, we have a lot of different meanings around it. But to me, it means to learn to accept reality as it is. In other words, become aware of our attachments and our aversions and find within those attachments and aversions, find an abiding sense of acceptance. So that I'm aware of the things I have an aversion to, and I'm very aware of the things I have an attachment to, but there is a space of clarity within them. Now, the way that this has typically been spoken of is the difference between, and sometimes it's translated as desire or craving or thirst. In the Pali, it is known as tana. Tana is the idea of craving something or desiring something in a way that it can never fulfill. In other words, craving or desiring an object that will never ultimately fulfill you. And so tana is the delusory sort of desire where we expect more from something than what it can really give us. And this takes us back to the teaching of projection, that we project onto something that somehow if we have that, it will fulfill us. That's tana. And that always leads to suffering because no matter whatever it is that we really want in life, we may not get it. Whatever it is in life that we have, want, we don't want, and we want to get rid of, we might not be able to get rid of. And whatever we have in life that we cherish and we don't want it to change, it will change. And so the practice of equanimity is the acceptance of this. And it doesn't mean we have to feel a certain way about it. Like, oh, yeah, I accept everything. No, it's a challenge. It's a wrestling. But it's a wrestling from a place of wisdom. So that we learn to realize that there is another form of desire, chanda. And that concept is that this will bring me wholeness. This will bring me oneness. So instead of seeking perfection, when I seek wholeness, that is achievable. And when I experience that wholeness, that will provide the fruits that really will satisfy me, that will really feed me. So that's equanimity. So those are the seven factors. It's once said in one of the sutras when the Buddha Shakyamuni was ill, he asked one of his disciples to recite the seven factors to him so that he could get well. And according to the legend, after he contemplated the seven factors, which he had taught, but he had someone teach them back to him, which is a really good practice, and I do it all the time, he was well again. And that shows you that being enlightened isn't about being perfect. The Buddha, throughout his life, after his great awakening, he continued to have things that would hook him. He continued to practice. He was not some stained glass figure that we could never really be. He was a human being, just like us. And everything that he experienced, we can too. There are four stages as well, or actually five stages, and I'm not going to go into all of it. Buddhists like to categorize things. So there's four different times of meditation absorption, and then those have both their yin and yang side, and then there are five stages. So again, this is something that would take a retreat to fully flesh, but I want you to hear it. So these are five stages that you can look at and ask yourself, is this something that's going on in my life? Is this what I'm doing? And if you are, you're enlightened. You're enlightened. The first stage is my identity or my view. In other words, do I believe that the five skandhas, you know, the aggregates of my ego self, do I believe that's all there really is? Or do I believe that there is a transcendent reality within this illusion that is my true self? In other words, do I believe the ego self's the whole story? Or do I believe there is a true self and that I can realize it? And by realizing it, the ego self is no longer my enemy, but it becomes something I take care of. The second thing, am I attached to rites and rituals? So this is something that I see sometimes. In other words, when people put ceremony before clarity, ceremony before clarity. Obviously, we practice a lot of ceremony here. But the ceremony, like all of our practices, meditation, chanting, whatever, they're to serve clarity, not the other way around. And all too often you see people make a fetish out of certain postures or certain mantras or certain physical movements, you know. But you can do all those postures and all those chants and all those movements downward dog. And none of that means anything if it is not in service of clarity. So one of the ways you know you're enlightened is you never put ceremony before clarity. Ceremony serves clarity. And that's how you know that ceremony really works for you. you develop confidence. If you're not practicing, you're not going to develop confidence. If you practice regularly, you develop confidence because you're like, oh, wow, that really worked. And so then you take it into something else. Oh, that really worked. And I'm feeling wholly different. I'm like a new person, a new being. And that's how you develop that confidence, but it comes from daily practice. You can't just practice when you get hooked. You got to do it all the time because that's how we keep that flame alive. One of the things that it talks about is these stages is to be free from, as I was saying, certain things or doing certain things. And one of those is that we know we're enlightened. We can say we're enlightened if we're not intentionally harming people. In other words, if we're clear that we're not ever intending to harm someone, you know. And maybe, you know, in this second stage, we haven't got quite there completely. You know, sometimes we still find ourselves, you know, thrown out the old evil eye. Well, we can still be enlightened. But we know that that's not quite right. So when we're enlightened, we wrestle with it. We don't just do it like we used to, mindlessly. Now we wrestle with it a little bit. We're clear about the difference between Tana and Chanda, as I explained earlier. And then the third stage is to be free from Tana, where we no longer look at anything and not realize it's not a projection. We're aware of that. And we can even enjoy our projections because it's something we do. And as they wax and wane like the cycles of the moon, it's okay. We have an abiding, centered equanimity. And we move from not intentionally harming to intentionally helping. So just the same way as that we do not intend to harm ourselves or others, we're very clear about our intention to help. And that, of course, is connected to the earlier concept of vigor, or vitality. And finally, in the fourth stage, we are free from the attachment to any concept, including oneness. We realize that at the beginning of everything, we practice not knowing. And even the great teachings of oneness and all those things, we're not attached to them. They're vehicles. They're vehicles to carry us to the other shore. And once we get to the other shore, we don't carry them around our backs. You know, it's like being in a canoe. We get to the other side of the shore. We don't carry that canoe around, drag it around. It's a vehicle. Likewise, we're not attached to the ideas of any kind of meditative, you know, we're not seeking a high like a drug addict. So even within the practice, we're free from any ideas or any delusions about enlightenment. We don't practice conceit anymore. Now, how I teach that is we learn to stop comparing ourselves to anyone else. We stop comparing ourselves to someone else. That's a big practice, but that's one of the ways we know we're enlightened because we're practicing that. Now you might get hooked. And we usually get hooked. And let's say we get hooked because I was comparing myself to someone. Oh, my book didn't sell as many books as that guy's book. Comparing myself. Well, it doesn't mean I won't get hooked. Remember, there's no perfection here, no quest for that. But wholeness, I recognize, oh, little Tony, he wishes his book sold as many as that person. It's okay, little Tony. I understand. It's okay, Bert. It's a good book. You stop comparing. Stop competing. You know, this is translated tradition as restlessness. But the way that I think is most skillful is you stop competing with others. Stop competing with others. Now, does that mean that somehow inherently competing is bad? No. Competing can be great fun. But again, the difference between tana and chanda. If I compete thinking that if I win, that will give me something that I don't already have, then that is tana. And in the end, that will create suffering. And I have seen it by people who have accumulated the fame and fortune that everyone seems to be craving from a certain evolutionary perspective. And it doesn't matter. They're suicidal too. So competing from tana leads to suffering. However, competing from chanda, it's just fun. It's just fun. It won't say anything significant about you if you get the big trophy. And you might feel confident on that day, but on the next day where you don't win the big trophy, if you're practicing from the place of chanda, it won't matter. It was just a game. And finally, the last part of the five stages, we stop grasping after enlightenment. We know that the old Japanese word I love is bonpu. We know we're foolish beings. We stop grasping after it. And when we do this and we realize, hey, I am awake. I am enlightened. We have a certain way of practicing. I love French words because they have a certain vigor to them. We learn to live fully, and that means by seeing things clearly. Voir clairement. We practice seeing things clearly. We don't trust the perception. We have a sense, a raison d'etre, and that is compassionate action. That's our raison d'etre. That's the raison d'etre of Buddhism, to relieve suffering through compassionate action. And finally, we live fully. We give completely. We have a joie de vivre. It doesn't turn us into some, you know, emotionless Vulcan. We can be very passionate. Great laughter, great chanda. We have a joie de vivre about life. And the simple things excite us. So let me finish with a parable. I call this the parable of the hot tub. So in this story, there is a village. And their great sensei has died. And they're very much in mourning and grieving. But they also know that they need a new sensei. They need someone to head up the temple and to run things and to help everyone continue in their path of liberation. So they put the word out. We're trying out new teachers. So come and try out. And they have a board of elders who's going to observe. So after some time, two candidates came. Now, one candidate was a mountain ascetic. He lived in a monastery way up on the mountains. And he comes down and you see him, you can just tell by looking at him, his physique. He was very fit. He seemed to be strong. He exuded power. He seemed to float above the ground. And he walks in very humbly and very somewhat stoically. He bows before the elders. And he says, I am here to present myself as a candidate for your temple, your great temple, and to follow in the footsteps of your great teacher. Okay. So the elders said, show us. Show us your power. Show us your teaching. Show us your enlightenment. So he says, that rice vat, when these rice vats, they cooked rice in, they were big like giant things. He says, empty that rice vat out and fill it with water. So they did that. This big vat, right? I always think of something from like Bugs Bunny when he was being hunted and put in the big vat, right? And then they put a fire. He says, put a fire underneath it and we're going to boil the water. So they boiled the water. and the water got hot and really hot, and sort of the bubbles started percolating on top. And people are like, what the heck's he gonna do, right? So he takes off his robe, takes off his underrobe. He's just there in his loincloth, and he's muscled from the tip of his head to his toes. Incredible. And he ascends the little steps that they place the stones in front of the vat. And in perfect, hear that, perfect, he enters into the water, doing some secret mantra to himself. And he steps into the water, and the people are all, and he gets completely into the water, and he submerges himself while practicing mudra. Complete equal poise. Water bubbling all around him, steam rising into the sky, and everyone's like, holy cow, he's gonna be burned alive. And after a few minutes, he gets up, stands up out of the water, steps outside the rice vat onto the stones, and steps down and bows before the elders. His skin's not even red. I mean, that's powerful. That's a powerful mental trick, man, to be able to do that. There's this guy that's real famous called Wim Hof. He's real popular right now, where he does this in ice water, right? So they said, well, thank you. Any other candidates? Well, there was one guy. And this guy comes up. He's got his robe on. His robe's a little dirty. He's a little chubby. Got a gut. And he walks up, waddles up to the group. Big smile on his face, missing a couple teeth. He bows to the elders. He says, I am here to present myself as a candidate for your great temple. And the elders are all kind of like, what the heck is this? You know, we just had this Superman. Now this guy? All right, let's humor him, right? They say, okay, show us your enlightenment. He says, okay. He says, wow. He looks at the water. He puts his finger a little bit. He goes, oh my God, that's hot. That guy, he actually sat in there. That is impressive. That is really impressive. Okay. He said, I tell you what. This big vat, right? Boiling still. He says, how about we put the fire out? So they put the fire out. And he said, how about you go down to the stream and get me some buckets of water? So they go down and get buckets of water. So they pour the first bucket in, and he puts his finger in. No, not a bucket. Put another bucket in, puts his finger in. Almost there. One more bucket. Pour another bucket of water, cold from the stream. Puts his fingers in, he's like, takes off his robe, waddles up the stones, puts his toe in, just right. Gets in, sits back against the edge of it, puts his arms up and goes, oh my goodness, is this good. Come on, he looks at the elders, join me. And the elders look at each other and they think, why not? Throw off their robes, and they climb in to the hot tub that this priest has created. He showed them their enlightenment. Which one do you think they chose?